Session number 27053.
Mr. Dre, Reel 10. Now, we're talking about your voyage out. We got to Naples, Italy, in January 1944.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Now, what were your first impressions when you got there?
Oh, well, it looked a dilapidated place. Of course, it had been bombed, the docks and that. There was a huge ship lying on her side. As a matter of fact, they were utilising it as part of the quay there. We saw mules being taken off a boat as we came in on nets, poor things, struggling, and but they were lifting the mules off there, coming from South America or something, and we thought, aye, must be mountains up there somewhere. But apart from that, we marched through to the station and got on a train. They marched us through the town to the station.
And was it badly battered, the town?
Yeah, it was battered fairly well. The docks area was battered, but not terribly. It wasn't...
And what about the civilians, the Italians?
Yeah, they came there and asked him for cigarettes and things as we marched along beside the road. We marched along. They marched beside us, the children, on about, have we got any cigarettes or chocolate and that, you see. But we weren't allowed to stop and chat to them. Of course, as we're marching and we got all our gear, we're carrying.
Now, where were your draft going to?
They took us to a place called Beni Yusuf. Benevento. Benevento.
Now, do you know how you spell these? I was just to check for
it. It would be Benevota, of T-O.
V-O-T-A.
Yeah. B-E-N-E, Benny, Vento. So it'd be
Benevento.
Yeah. Benevento.
And whereabouts, roughly?
Well,
that?
that's just north, not far, mid Italy, just north of, maybe about 50 miles, I suppose, from Naples.
And what happened there?
That's a holding. It's a what they call a CRU, a casualty reinforcement unit. And they put us into tents there because it wasn't terribly cold and that, but it wasn't sunny sunshine, mind. And so we were intended, and then within a day or so we knew we were going to the North Ants, and they asked for any volunteers to join the battalion, and I said yes, I'll go to the battalion right away. So we were shipped in lorries, and our battalion was up. They'd just been in a terrible battle for the Sangro River. They'd just completed that of the Sangro River, and they were waiting up there. They were out of the line. The town, I can't remember what town it was. I could tell you, because the book would tell us where they are. Do you want to know the place?
We'll look it up later and slot yeah. it in. Yeah. So what were your first impressions on joining them?
Well, got to the battalion. Well, of course, we were...
This was the which battalion?
5th Battalion of the North Ants. They were part of the 11th Brigade of the 78th Division.
And which company were you joining this time?
I was joining C Company, yeah.
So another rifle company?
Yes.
You still a rifleman,
yeah, right, yeah. Yeah.
What were your first impressions of the state of them? They've just been in this battle.
They were a different calibre of soldiers. It was obvious to a fool that they were a different calibre than we'd been used to. They were reluctant really to tell us a lot about the war, about what it was like. They, you know, were more about. They were thinking more about getting a glass of vino and cigarettes and things like that. They were on rest, you see, and vino was easy to come by. Farms had it anywhere. So they certainly weren't spit and polish brigade. There wasn't any too much duty. There was no polishing boots and things like that. So, but they'd talk about the war and that, you know, keep your head down, you'll be all right. But we were all inquisitive, you see, but they just accepted that they'd been in the battle and that was it, like, and they were a good battalion. They all proud of the battalion, so you knew you didn't have let them down. You'd got to pull your part and be one of them, or else you weren't going to be well, very welcome. Things you wanted to know that were essential, like you didn't know about the battalion, they would quickly tell you and inform you, no time at all, you were accepted the battalion.
Who were the key figures that you, you know, your people like your platoon sergeant, your second lieutenant and your major, do you remember their names or any that stand out to you from the time?
My lieutenant was Ferriers. Ferriers. I think it's F-E-R-R-I-E-R. Ferrier. Ferrier. That was his name. And
what was he like? What was so impressive?
Oh, he was quite good. He was young and he was not a professional soldier. It was obvious he hadn't been in the army long, in action himself very much. But he was quite a pleasant man, and my sergeant major was Sergeant Major Stamford, and I had a bit of luck here. He came from Axminster. Yeah, Axminster. It was in East Devon, and he was a Devonian. So although he told me quite a number of times I was a disgrace to the British Army, he sort of had a fatherly feeling for me, you know. He was half joking when he tells me that if I'd done something that he didn't like or something, he'd say, "You're a damn disgrace to the British Army, Dre," and all sort of thing, you see. But joking with me.
Any other officers or NCOs?
Well, my company commander was Cook.
Major Cook,
he was, yeah.
What was he like?
He was a soldier. He didn't have much to do with us at all. They allocate that to sergeants and platoon commanders, but he was a good officer. Yeah.
Were the officers generally good? I mean.
Oh yes, good officers.
What did you look for in a good officer? What made a good officer for you?
Well, one that didn't panic and didn't start, you know, showing his incompetence, if you like, and sometimes his fear, if he was nervous at all. And I'd known them like it, I can tell you later.
But if they were
cool, calm and collected and just said, "Oh, you're Dre, you're one of the new intake, and, oh, well, welcome to the platoon, and I hope you're fitting all right," and the general attitude like that sort of thing. Yeah, and if they wouldn't expect you to do too much either. I mean, if something had to be carried, then he would allocate six men to do it. If it was a six-man job or whatever, he wouldn't think, you know, they didn't put upon us at all.
And what about your NCOs, your sergeants?
Yeah,
what were they like?
They're good all round. They are, really.
Did you look for anything different from them as an NCO rather than an officer, or were you?
Yeah. A platoon sergeant is your mother, he's God to you, a platoon sergeant, and you can tell them the way they talk and that. They don't have to shout, they say, "Do so and so," and you know it's got to be done. You just say, "Yes, sergeant," or "No, sergeant," or "Right, sergeant." But if he says to you, "Look, get on down the cookhouse and get them rations, bring the rations up, or go down to the quartermaster's, some ammunition will come up, you went and done it." But they didn't shout, they didn't show any, try to overrule you by nonsense of do this, do that. And if you were like Miss B. Saving, they cut that lark out now, no more of that. And once they said, you know, if you was messing about, cut that lark out and get doing so and so, then they would do it. Eh? You haven't got, you know, but they didn't have to shout, they just told you to do it. And they expected it to be obeyed, or to be obeyed. A lot of people talk about barrack training when they shout to you. And shouting "freeze," that's one of the things when you're marching. They might say "freeze." And what they're training you for is if you get in a situation, if you're in a minefield or something like this, you must obey that command. So this parade in shouting the commands. It's really to discipline you to for your own benefit. If they give a command when you're in action, they expect it to be done without hesitation. Why should I do this? Or you would never say that. Why? If someone told you to do it. And corporals, they are almost like yourself. And they'd say, we are going to do this, or we're going to do that, or I want you to do that. Exactly the same. The NCOs, if they had two stripes or three stripes in a battalion at the front, you know they justified it. Quite a few carried decorations, MM ribbons and things. Because the battalion had been in North Africa, my 5th North Hants, in the 1st Army. And so they'd seen some fight in North Africa, Sicily, Termoli, up through Italy, you see. And Sangro was a tough fight for them. And you knew, they knew what it's all about. And they know they're not going to be too hard on you because you might be dead in a week or two time. Or you might be in a tight corner with them and they depend on you. So, no, it's a different kettle of fish altogether. It's much like in civilian life. You get a party of men working on a building site. By and large, the foreman says, do this or do that. They do it without any arguing. And that was with them. But I can't say that they shone out like a star or anything. But there were certain sergeants that they were... We had one, for instance, a sergeant major, Sags. And he was scruffy as a soldier. He was scruffy, come from the Buffs. He was on attachment to us. Brilliant soldier, though. And fearless. Fearless. And it didn't seem... He almost was treated shellfire, stonk, as we called it, with contempt. What the hell was the matter with you? You know, sort of thing. A damn shell's just burst beside you. What's the matter with you if you're jumping about? There is a true saying, you know, only those that have been there among you understand all this jargon. If I was talking to another bloke in my battalion, he'd know, you know, I'd say, old Sags, and he'd say, oh, yeah. And he'd know exactly what Sags was like, this sergeant, you know, brilliant he was, lent from the Buffs to us, because they were another battalion in our brigade.
Now, we've just looked up, and you joined them at Casal Nuovo and Vecchio, Casal Vecchio, and that's where you originally joined them.
Yeah.
Now, you weren't there long, though, were you?
No, only a matter of days, and they were about to be switched across to the central Italy.
And what do you remember of that trip?
Well, it was nothing, really. I remember... The guns were forward of us there. We could hear them rumbling in the distance, and gradually we heard no guns as because we were moving south towards Benevento, as a matter of fact, for our stay. Before we were moved up to the monastery, we were going up to the monastery in a month's time.
The Monte Cassino.
Yeah.
So, but you went to Benevento first.
Yeah, down in that area. Back
and,
down there.
And what were you doing in Benevento?
Well, the rest of the lads. I told you I volunteered to join the battalion immediately. All the others came up from the CRU and they joined us. And of course we swaggered around like old soldiers because we're in the battalion. You see, we're in the div signs and God knows what. And they had just come out of recruits from the CRU, I remember. But we didn't do very much. The only thing we done, they made sure that we had all our uniforms were complete, all our equipment was complete, because of course every time you come out the line, you lose a certain amount of gear. So everything, and then we made sure that we were all units were brought up to strength, the full, Reggie Cook gave us a few talks, that's their company commander, about you know that they called this the major battle that was got to come off. It was like a D-Day to break through at Cassino. Although the Sangro had been a terrible battle, the Monte Cassino was the one, a bit of a tough dog up there. So when we left there, I can't remember every place we went, but we went up to a place near Mont Trocco. near Casino. That's where we landed. You know, they let us down off the trucks. And then my company, or my battalion, I should say.
In the history, it mentions about Capua. Is that near?
Capua, yeah, that's right.
When was that?
That was another camp we'd gone up to, Capua. These were 78th Division camps allocated to them. Because the Capua, yeah, and because later when we came back to Picur again, but we were there. Yes, that's true.
So when did you move up to a Casino? Well,
March, early February.
Early February, yeah.
Something like that. Mm.
And what happened then? You're moving up for this is the big battle, isn't it?
All yeah, but we went up there and we were at my company, were allocated a position up around the back of the monastery in the mountain. It's called the Snake's Head Ridge. From the area, it looked like a snake's head, the ridge. And we were in Sangers because we couldn't dig in. And we marched up this track this night. They moved us up. And mules were taking supplies up. They took us across the valley in jeeps the first time, I remember. They had this bit of road. It was all smoked by, and they were shelling the valley with smoke shells so the Germans couldn't see. But we went up at night in any case. And then we climbed up this track. Awful it was. And all our gear and everything we were carrying up this track into what they call the bowl, a big bowl up in the mountains. And that was battalion headquarters, so we were there. And
that's on Snake's Head Ridge?
No, this was just behind the Snake's Head, about a half a mile back. But the forward positions where we were going to occupy was the Snake's Head Ridge, just in front of Point 593, the Indians had had a go, Americans had had a go at it, and they couldn't capture it. East Surrey's, I think, had had a go at it. Or Sussex Regiment, one of them. So we got into the bowl and we settled down for the night. Then the next day we were going to relieve the East Surreys that were in the positions up front. And I remember the RSM actually there. He was talked to us younger fellas that had only just joined the battalion, had seen no action. He said, "I don't know if any of you have seen dead men or smelt death at all, but you're going to smell it tonight and you're going to experience tonight," he said. "But I want you to understand this," he says, "that this is war, that it's your first time going up into the front line, so you know what to expect." He gave us this talk and off we went. And we went in what they call ACAC formation, like 15 section, 15 men, one behind the other, being led by a corporal. And we went up and into the Sangers. Sure enough, it was all rocky. There was no trees or anything. It burnt, and where shells had set fire to any foliage there was, all rocks. And there was American dead and Indian dead up there, and the stench was terrible. It was terrible. And we got there's a little old farm hut place there. It was a shepherd's hut or something, but brick and mortar. And that was going to be our company headquarters. But we were taken on just up onto this ridge. It was a knife-edge ridge. The Germans were 60 yards from us when we got in there, so we had to be very quiet as we moved in. And they came out, and we went in, and it was like a Sanger is a small stone breastwork, they call it. But they had put old rifles and things across the top and put stones on top, so it was more like an Eskimo's igloo made of stones. You crawled in a hole, and there was two men to a Sanger. And we had this piece of this ridge and holding.
Can you describe the Sangers in any more detail? Because they're quite unusual in that.
They are. Well, they were built almost like a horseshoe of rock, about 2 foot 6, 3 feet high inside. Then I hadn't done it. The previous people that had really built them, the Indians and that had captured this piece at night, there were lots of old rifles laying around up. The American automatic rifles, all sorts, smashed up gears, helmets, all sorts lay up there. And they placed these things across like rafters and put stones on top of it. So in the end, it was like a sort of round dome little shelter.
What was it like inside?
Well, we had lots of blankets inside. Everyone had left their blankets and rather carry them out. So you had a good layer of several blankets on the floor. And in between, I mean, there was holes in the rock. So as a matter of fact, we could look through one of them and watch the monastery, which was 400 yards away down a valley. And we could right opposite the monastery.
Was it down a valley and then up?
Yes.
So you were on the facing, basically.
That's right. Just looking at the monastery, like looking at that hill on it, much closer. And we could look through this hole, but you don't go out at night, because they could see you. So what happened, they gave you little Tommy cookers. They were like sort of solid methylated things you use for firelighters, that sort of thing, or for meth, you know, like it was solid meth cubes. And you had a little Tommy cooker, and you could open a tin of, say, it was mainly McConaughey's, that's the manufacturer's name, for a meat and vegetable stew that was in the tin. And you could have it on this little cooker and it would heat it for you. You could boil a drop of water in your mess tin and we had compote tea, which was tea, dried milk and sugar in appropriate quantities, in all mixed up. And you threw a handful of this into your tin, the boiling, and that settled, of course, but the milk and sugar dissolved and went with your tea, and you had a cup of tea.
Can you tell us a bit more about the food? How did it come up, the food?
Well, it came up, yeah, a lot of it was dried food, and was compote, yeah. But a lot of it was tin food, you see. And bread came up as neat bread, chunks of bread in sandbags. So you had to pick all the hessian hair off of it before you could eat it. But it came up by mules to the bowl. Then each company allocated so many carriers, went back to the bowl and brought up the platoon or company's rations. So many men from each platoon went back each night and brought up the rations. Now, they would give us tin soya sausages, tin bacon, but one between two men, say. Not that this one will give you as alternatives. They would give you, you had so many chunks of this bread, it was cut, but that was so much weight per man. You would have tin rice, for instance, that would come up. This, plenty of bully beef, there was tons of it. You could have tins and tins. They brought up tins of bully beef for you, so you didn't go hungry. But it was rather monotonous. But then there was cooks in the bowl and they would do a bully stew and that. And we had men go back, some of them that weren't carrying like sandbags with the tins and that. Others would have had two big canisters, thermos things that kept it hot. Like they had in the Great War, almost identical. And they would fill it with stew and you would have it on your back. I have carried them. They were quite heavy when there were two of them. And we got to this hut where the doctor was in there and company headquarters. And they also brought the mail up as well. And they, believe it or not, on these positions, they brought up a small bottle of beer once a week, naffy rations, bar of soap and a piece of chocolate and so forth, some chewing gum, came up each week. And was allocated to each man, and the quartermaster sergeant, so the army was so well organised that was deducted from your wages when you come out the line. They knew that you'd had that ration and a bottle of beer. They wasn't canned beer and a 50 tin of cigarettes, 50 in a tin. And there were so many cigarettes up there. When we came out of these sangers and another battalion, we were up there about a week. Then another battalion would come up and took over. We'd leave our cigarettes in the sangar, and they would leave theirs. So there was hundreds of cigarettes. So all you could do all day was talk and smoke.
I'll be coming down. Did you have a rum ration?
No.
Was that just your unit, or was that general then?
Our unit never. I never had rum. I've had rum, but I'm going to tell you they come there. But I there wasn't a rum ration. No. Whether the sergeant major was drinking it, I don't know. But I never had a rum ration.
How was your day organised? Well, if you take us through from when you say you woke up, if you've been to sleep. But I mean, would there be a stand too? I mean,
yes.
Take the day through.
You, in the infantry, it doesn't matter where you are, and you're a front line, you stand to an hour before dark, or an hour till after, an hour before, and an hour after dark. And that's at night. An hour before and an hour after dark, everyone stood to.
Can you explain exactly what a stand to meant?
What it meant for me in the Sanger, we'd have our helmets and all our equipment ready and our rifles loaded and everything. But this what we'd do. And then as it got dark, then they would come and the sergeant would come around and collar you out. Some would, and my friend and I that was in, he was called Newton, later killed at Bologna. He would bring the Bren gun up, and I was number two on the Bren gun. And we had to go right up on this ridge. And we had like a little wall run along, and we had some blankets up there. And we would sit with our machine gun there, because the Germans were 60 yards down under us. So we could hear them at night sometimes trip over tins or one thing or another down there. And so we'd do up there 2 hours, four off, just like on a guard anywhere else. That would be our duty nearly every night. Unless we were on carrying party.
Hang on, tell us more about the night. So this was a Bren gun guard, basically.
Yes, yeah. It was the front line. So and other men would be up on the ridge with their rifles, just rifles and grenades. But we'd all be up there until it got about an hour after dark. We'd know they're not going to attack, so they'd stand down. Well, then that's when they'd send them back for... But the machine gun would stay there, and certain riflemen would. 2 hours, like they'd... Say there's a quarter of the... Or third, about a third of the platoon would stay up on the ridge, but the other two-thirds could go back. Some of them would be allocated to go up and fetch water up, because all the water had to come up by mule. And all the food, so they'd have to go down carrying supplies. And when they'd got it up, of course, then they'd go in and the sergeant would allocate, you know, he'd have a ladle and ladle you.
Well, tell me what it's like on a ration party or a supply party then. When you did that, didn't
you?
Oh,
yes,
yeah. What was it like then? How bad was it?
Well, it wouldn't, because it was heavy loads we were carrying and stumbling in these rocks. And they had some parts of it were taped even for us. And what?
Taped.
Well, they had white tape. Had a white tape each side of us, for us to follow, so that we could see. Because there wasn't all paths, not all of it. The night, so that we could see. And all night long, we and the Germans both fired Very lights up. Now, this is another time when that word freeze comes in. As soon as you could hear the click, you could hear it, and up it would come, and then it would burst like a rocket in the air. And then slowly come down, and the whole place was lit like bright moonlight. And what you'd done, as soon as you heard the click, you froze, perfectly still. You didn't jump down on the ground, you froze. Bow your head and freeze. Now, if you start moving, that's when the Germans they're looking for movement. But that was one of the things that were a bit frightening, the constant firing of these Very lights up. And then... There was an old well up there on this ridge, a dirty old well that the old shepherds must have used, and we couldn't get drinking water out of it because we didn't know what was down there. But if you got a bucket of water up and let it settle, you could get some water to shave or wash. But the trouble was you had to be very careful you didn't bang the side of the thing with the bucket or tin that we were putting down to get the water, because the Germans had a fixed machine gun line on it, and for no reason at all he'd sometimes just fire a burst of Spandau machine gun at it in and around this well area. So it was always a bit ear raising to go down and get a bit of water, so most fellas chose not to wash. But also on the pars, he knew near enough where we were moving at night, and we knew where he was, of course. And sometimes he would try to whop some mortars down on us, but he was mainly after the mule track. He didn't concentrate on the higher path where we were walking down to the bowl very much. But we had to go down there, and then we're lugging up 2 petrol cans full of water, or sandbags of bread, about 4 sandbags full, and all sorts of things that had to be carried forward. It wasn't easy at all. You were sweating by the time you got back, not from fear but from labor, you know.